Thomas Cohen. Congress, the White House, and the U.S. Supreme Court were all busy last week. President Obama touted the 7.1 million Americans who have signed up for health care through the exchanges. The U.S. Supreme Court changed campaign finance laws by lifting the cap on the number of candidates running for federal office that a person can support. The Senate Intelligence Committee voted to declassify a report about the CIA's controversial interrogation program carried out under President Bush. Congressman Paul Ryan proposed a new budget that would cut trillions in spending, and Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal offered an alternative to Obamacare. We're here to talk about these national news stories and more are Reed Wilson and J. Newton Small. Reed Wilson covers state politics and policy for the Washington Post GovBeat blog. He's also editor and lead author of the Post's Read In Morning Tip Sheet. Reed Wilson, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks, Marty. It's good to be here.
Nice to have you here. And also with us, as I said, J. Newton Small. She's Washington correspondent for Time Magazine. And, J., nice to have you back with us as well.
Thanks for having me on.
J., let me begin with you. And I'm wondering, beginning with the Supreme Court decision of last week, who do you see as the winners?
Well, there's plenty. Winners is certainly the Republicans, because they have a lot more high-dollar donors who have said repeatedly that they get capped out, that they can't give anymore, and so this will enable them to sort of give much more money across the board and not just limit it, sort of pick and choose whether they're going to give $20,000 to the RNC and to the, for example, the Congressional Committee. Now they can give $20,000 to, the RNC, the Congressional Committee, the Senate Committee, the Governor's Committee, so they can really spread around that money. You can also say that the donors in general, anybody who's believes that corporations are people, as donors sometimes are classified as by the Supreme Court, are also winners. And, big proponents of the First Amendment have argued that this is a good thing for freedom of the press. This is a good thing for First Amendment free speech. The question is, though, how much does it taint our politics going forward, and is it a sacrifice in that sense?
And picking up on that and going to you, Reed, what I learned over the weekend is that there are about 600 people in this country who have met that aggregate limit, and most people do not give, the maximum amount of campaign money during a cycle.
Right. So let's step back for a moment and review what the decision was. The decision ended what are called the aggregate limits on what a donor can give to federal candidates and campaign committees. So the donor can give $2,600 per election to any particular candidate. So that effectively means $5,200, because there's always a primary election and a general election. They can give up to about, I think it's $48,000 to the candidates under the old rules that the Supreme Court just struck down, and then another $70,000 or so to the party committees themselves, to the, as Jay said, the Democratic National Committee, the Republican National Committee, et cetera, for a total of $123,000. Now, there are only 591 people who actually hit that limit back in 2012, and this ruling will give them the opportunity to spread that money around more. The funny thing about this, not to sort of feel sorry for the people who are giving $123,000 every election cycle, but a lot of them will hit that limit, that aggregate limit of $123,000, and then be able to tell the other senators, representatives, people running for office who call, sorry, no can do, I've already hit my aggregate limit. Mm. Well, now there are no more aggregate limits, and so those people are going to be hit up for more and more money. The real winners in this, though, are the party committees themselves. I mean, it's not just the Republicans, it's also the Democrats. The Democratic National Committee right now is $15 million in debt, largely because they're competing with like Jay mentioned, the Senate committee and the House committee for their money, their donations, those big donors. So there was one official at the Democratic National Committee who was quoted last week saying that he was happier for this ruling than a pig in what pigs roll in.
This is both sides. Go ahead, Jay.
I would also argue that the Democratic National Committee has this whole set of separate issues with Organizing for America, kind of gutting it, and their challenges raising money, not so much the fact that they're limited by fundraisers.
But I think something like $7 billion was spent in the 2012 election cycle. So if it's, when there's a someone running for president, I'm assuming that's when a lot of money gets spent. I'm assuming, Jay, looking at 2016, we're going to see even more money spent?
Yeah, it's amazing when you think about it. The last election was, what, $1 billion election, they say, overall, and it, you're definitely going to see a lot more money for 2016, just because this is sort of, a lot of experts anticipate this is just the first decision that the Supreme Court has, and then there'll be others down the road, which will increasingly lift any kind of limits off of campaign spending. And so as you look towards 2016, it really just looks to be just huge amounts of money in politics. I mean, it's unbelievable how much money will probably be spent in that election.
And Reid, even going back to the Supreme Court and some of the writing from some of the justices, does it look, and even including Citizens United, does it look that at least the Supreme Court is going in the direction of just essentially lifting all limits on campaign donations?
I wouldn't go so far as to say lifting all limits, but they're certainly lifting a large number of them incrementally, as opposed to sort of one big sweeping ruling that would undercut all of the Campaign Reform Act of 1972 or of the McCain-Feingold law that was passed about a decade ago. We have seen now the Roberts Court, especially, has been moving towards the direction of, I hate calling them the anti-reformers, but the people who opposed the McCain-Feingold ruling, in that, you know, they equate money with speech, and that is not something that those who support McCain-Feingold and other campaign finance provisions are in favor of, and it's something they've been working against for quite a while. But this court is again slowly moving in that direction, and we saw in this decision written by John Roberts, there was an agreement, a concurrent opinion from Justice Clarence Thomas, who said no, that the $5,200 limit placed on how much state or individuals can give these candidates, those should be lifted as well. So, you know, that could be the next step. I'm not entirely convinced that it will be, though. One of the, Jay hit this just a second ago, but one of the real big implications of this ruling is that this is not the end. There are next steps to come, and already we've seen several states, Massachusetts, Vermont is taking a look at theirs, that have their own aggregate limits that are now saying, well, we can't enforce these, so they're effectively off the books, too.
Jay, just picking up on what you both have said, obviously it leads to the conclusion, and there is a Supreme Court decision, the Buckley decision, basically equating money and speech. But looking at this decision, then the more money you have, what, the more speech you get to have as well.
I mean, that is sort of the general, I mean, First Amendment advocates will say that, yes, that is the general implication, that that you cannot limit, that the money is sort of equated to speech, and that the way you choose to spend your money is a way that you are, in fact, speaking, and so therefore you cannot limit that support. And so therefore, First Amendment advocates consider the case is actually a huge victory for them, because they believe that it sort of furthers the freedom of speech in America. Now, the question is, you know, there are examples like in, you know, Arizona and other places where the states have said, actually, you know, when you start to sort of damage a system or damage other people, then that freedom of speech should be limited. So it is an evolving debate, and I think you will see increasing cases coming before the court in the next few years, questioning this definition of freedom of speech and whether people equal corporations, whether, you know, which is sort of the Citizens United case, and how that. Whether that interpretation can really stand not only for freedom of speech, but let's say freedom of religion, which is the Arizona case. Like, can corporations discriminate based off of freedom of religion the way individuals theoretically can under the law? And so it creates a kind of conundrum, because if you equate money and people and corporations all into one thing, then where do you draw the limits on a number of different issues?
You want to wrestle with that, Reid?
Well, look, there are already attorneys who are working on the next round of cases, and they have been for quite a while. One of the things that I think we're going to see fall eventually is the ban on so-called soft money. This was the McCain-Feingold ban on unlimited contributions to parties that could be given for non-political purposes. That is, you know, the Democratic National Committee has a headquarters building. Well, how do you pay for it if the elevator breaks down? Well, you pay for it with soft money or something like that. Very slowly, a number of rules have been passed and approved by the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, that have chipped away at those soft money regulations. At first, there were you know, they asked to allow parties to raise money for recounts, and then they asked to allow the parties to raise money for recounts before there were recounts, so that there would be money in the bank the day after Election Day. And then they asked if they could use that recount funding for building expenses. So, you know, very slowly, some of the other parts of McCain-Feingold are being chipped away, campaign reform at all, are being chipped away, both not only at the Supreme Court, but also at the district court level and also at the Federal Election Commission.
Well, Jay, it does seem when you look back over, you know, now decades of laws about campaign finance restrictions, is that there seems to be always a way around whatever laws or restrictions are put in place. There is a workaround that seems to evolve.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I mean, I think that when McCain-Feingold was first passed, you certainly saw a lot more candidates taking federal fund, matching funds from the government. I think it would be hard to imagine these days any presidential campaign accepting matching funds at this point, because it limits them so grossly. And as these laws have been struck down, you've seen the sort of dismantling of the entire public financing system of campaigns. So I think things have changed enormously, and there were, you know, the limits were actually quite effective back in the day, and the real challenge now, I mean, Congress has tried to pass legislation to reimpose limits in a different way, but they've stumbled across special interest groups that, you know, are powerful lobbies like the National Rifle Association that essentially brought down the last attempt to reform these laws a couple of years ago that was authored by Chris Van Hollen of Maryland. There isn't a real way, I think, to sort of put the genie back in the bottle at this point and to reimpose those caps that were, frankly, fairly effective in the beginning and have now essentially, they're sort of gone or in the process of being gone.
Well, and about a minute before our first break here, Reba, I mean, should we just get used to the system? This is the system that we have. We just better get used to it?
Well, until somebody comes up with some new version of the law that we can pass, then yes, there is no movement in Congress to actually get any kind of new campaign finance reform going, or at least no movement that has any serious hopes of passing. One of the things that I would just point out quickly is that in this ruling, I mean, the original caps were placed to prevent the appearance or the actual happenstance of corruption. In this ruling from last week, John Roberts, the Chief Justice, placed a very high bar on how to prove corruption. So that argues that, you know, that in favor of more money in the system.
Well, and what he's saying is it's really about what influence buying votes. So that's corruption, right?
Buying votes and then buying official actions once a member of Congress actually gets to the floor of the House or the Senate.
A real quid pro quo rather than this sort of a more amorphous influence.
Exactly. The barrier, the standard by which somebody would have to prove the appearance of corruption is now much higher than it was before this ruling came out.
And that's Reed Wilson. He covers state politics and policy for The Washington Post. Also with us, J. Newton Small, Washington correspondent for Time Magazine, catching up on some of the issues in Washington. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. What do you think of that Supreme Court decision? Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Arcadia University's Graduate School is committed to helping students further their careers. Arcadia University School of Education is hosting an open house on April 8th. It's an opportunity to learn about innovative certificates in connected learning, urban education, and ESL. Offering one-on-one course planning and financial options at the Arcadia April 8th Graduate Education Open House. Registration at arcadia.edu/grad-open-house. Arcadia University supports WHYY.
The Morris Arboretum supports WHYY and welcomes spring with a celebration of the Japanese Cherry Blossom Festival on two Saturdays in April, April 12th and April 19th, with live drummers, samurai arts, kimono dressing, and more. Guided walks of Morris Arboretum's ornamental cherry collection are offered both Saturdays. Located in Chestnut Hill, spring is in bloom. Details at morrisarboretum.org. The Morris Arboretum proudly supports WHYY.
The Kimmel Center supports WHYY and presents Philadanko, Philly's own modern dance ensemble, April 17th through the 19th in Perlman Theater. After touring extensively this season, Philodanko returns to the Kimmel Center with Blood, Sweat, and Dance, which includes works by Rennie Harris, Donald Byrd, and Gene Hill Sagan, and features the company premiere of choreographer Ulysses Dove's Bad Blood. Tickets for Philodanko's Blood, Sweat, and Dance are available at KimmelCenter.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Jay Newton Small and Reed Wilson. It's a national political roundup, catching up on some of the news coming out of Washington, D.C. And again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss-Cohen. Jay, let me put something else on the table here, which was, as of last week, according to the White House, something like 7.1 million people signed up for healthcare through the exchange. I think back in October, we would not necessarily have predicted that so many people would have done that. What does that tell you?
Well, you know, it's certainly a victory for Democrats who have been struggling to sort of prove that the system is viable, that it's not going to collapse under its own weight, as a lot of Republicans have argued that it would, and they're trying to sort of show that there will be benefits, that people will benefit from this, and that Obamacare is actually a good thing. And so, in that sense, it was a victory for Democrats, but the law remains incredibly beleaguered and incredibly unpopular, and I think it's going to be very difficult to turn it into a positive, a net positive for them come the midterm elections.
And unpopular, sort of broadly speaking, because it seems that when you break down specific pieces of the bill, there seems to be support for those pieces.
It's true that if you ask people, what do you think about getting rid of pre-existing conditions, of filling the sort of Medicare Part D donut hole, you know, all of these provisions that are in the bill, or at least attached to the bill, those are incredibly popular provisions. But I think the problem is that the Democrats have never really done a great sales job of this law. And a lot of people have no idea, frankly, that some of these things that they really like are in the bill. And so when you ask them, do you like Obamacare, they just, you know, reflexively say no. But then when you ask them about the particular parts of Obamacare, they say, well, actually, yeah, I do kind of like that. But what all they hear about is the president saying, you know, you said he's promised you could keep your doctor, you promised you could keep your insurance plan if you liked it, and those were not true. And so they hear all the negative things because, you know, that's what the Republicans have been really vocal and effective, frankly, in messaging in the last 2 years, and the Democrats have been much less effective in sort of defending the law and promoting its upsides.
Reed, is this a challenge for the Democrats? I mean, it's a bill associated with the Democratic Party and certainly the Democratic president. Has it become a problem for the Democrats?
Well, it's a huge problem for the Democrats, and it's a huge problem because it starts at the very sort of philosophical underpinning, if you will, of President Obama's entire time in office. You know, he was elected back in 2008. I always joke that he was elected more because of the change than the hope. People saw a government that was not functioning, that was not working well under George W. Bush, and they wanted somebody who would just make the government work well. So here comes a Democratic president whose overt sort of pitch to voters was, I can make government work better for you because government really does have a role in society. And now, not only did they botch the rollout and the website wasn't working, but there, you know, in a lot of these states that actually advanced their own exchanges, there are even bigger problems. In Democratic-led states like Hawaii and Maryland and Oregon, the exchanges are still an epic disaster. In Oregon, you can't even sign up online. Hawaii only signed up like 8,000 people, which was, you know, a tenth of what they expected to. Maryland's system is so bad that they had to scrap their entire technology, and they went up to Connecticut and borrowed the Connecticut exchange system that's now going to be implemented for next cycle's open enrollment. So here we have examples of government not working, and that is, I mean, that's sort of the identity crisis, or rather, in sort of an ideological an identity crisis for the Democratic Party, a party that says that government can actually work for you.
But you've got states like Kentucky. I mean, there are some states where it's actually worked quite well.
There are. Kentucky has worked especially well. Washington State has worked especially well. California, after a few early hiccups, has worked pretty well. So there are some states that did it really well and some states that did it really poorly. And the bugs have not been worked out from those states that did it really poorly.
Let me get, looks like Tim from Hillsborough, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Tim. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. My question is this. The jury is still out on Obamacare because, although they have 7 million people signed up, we don't know if those people are going to continue paying, making their payments. Some of those people are people who lost their insurances because of the system. And my point is, 7 million people is only 2% of this population. Mm-hmm. And we have spent millions and billions of dollars on these programs for 2% of the population. That's the part I don't get.
Well, Tim, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Jay, can you respond to that? Obviously, people who get their insurance through their workplace, they were not part of the effort to try to sign people up. It was the uninsured. It was the young and healthy people.
Well, I mean, so the Obamacare law doesn't, or, you know, the Affordable Care Act, as the Democrats call it, all of it is not just these 7 million people signing up. There's a huge expansion of Medicaid that's included in this in state-by-state basis. There's also, which has been postponed for a year, the small business exchanges, which will also enroll anticipated millions more of people. All told, there, when we sort of went into this, when we were passing the Obamacare back in, 2010, 2011, 2009, 2010, there were anticipated 30 million people that this law would bring into the system. There are about 50 million people in America who do not have health care, which, yes, in, relatively speaking, to the 360 million odd Americans that are out there, that's not, you know, that's not a huge amount of Americans, but it is a fair amount. And keep in mind that these people are, you know, a huge burden on the system because when they get sick, everybody else has to subsidize their coverage and their treatment. So in order to bring those people into the system, you really need to expand the system enormously. And so there is, all told, Obamacare should cover about 30 million people in the next 10 years, or I guess now the next 8 years. And that is a significant amount of the uninsured, especially when you consider that out of that uninsured, about 11 million of them are illegal immigrants who wouldn't qualify for any of these laws anyway. So it does go a long way to actually covering an enormous amount of the uninsured in America.
Reed, let me pick up on this and go back to you. And there certainly are and have been critics of the Affordable Care Act. The pushback has been, tell us how you would do a better health care reform. Bobby Jindal, the governor of Louisiana, has offered something called the Freedom and Empowerment Plan. Is there something, do you think, in there that would resonate with people who are more reluctant to embrace the Affordable Care Act?
Well, just like the Affordable Care Act has a number of constituent parts that are very popular, so too does Bobby Jindal's plan. And now, these are not terribly new ideas. They're sort of the Republican ideas for health care reform that have been kicking around for the last decade or so. Things like making insurance available across state lines so that somebody living in Philadelphia could buy insurance in Baltimore from a Maryland company or something like that if they found a cheaper rate. And, they're sort of these ideas that we've heard before that poll very well, and who knows if they'll be if they would bend the cost curve down as much as the Affordable Care Act claims to be able to. The Jindal proposal, though, I thought was interesting because it was the first sort of real policy proposal that isn't just repeal the Affordable Care Act of the 2016 presidential election. I mean, here is a guy who knows a lot about healthcare policy. He was this is crazy. He was the healthcare director of the state of Louisiana in his 20s, which
hard
boggles my mind.
It does mine as well.
Makes me feel like an underachiever here, but so he knows a lot about policy. He wants to be sort of the wonky policy oriented candidate in this field, and Republicans have recently started to talk more in ways about how to replace than how to repeal. They want to offer some kind of positive alternative because they don't just want to be seen as the party of no. That's a really bad place to be when you're talking about leading the government in 2016 or even in 2014 in the midterms.
And that's Reed Wilson, covers state politics and policy for the Washington Post GovBeat blog. He's also the editor and lead author of the Post's Read In, that's READ, in Morning Tip Sheet. Also with us, Jay Newton Small, and she's Washington correspondent for Time Magazine. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Let me get another caller in, wants to talk about the Supreme Court decision. This is John from Westchester. John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
I wanted to make a brief point. We can talk about activist courts and ideological courts, and of course it depends on whose ox is being gored. I would think a lot of people would agree that this court is extremely activist, but there have been extremely activist courts on the left too. But I think there's a more important point here that I haven't heard commented on, and that is that there are principles that go beyond the Constitution. And one of those is the principle of stare decisis, the principle that in the common law, which we are, courts have to be bound by their prior decisions.
Precedence.
They cannot simply change a decision because the constitution of the court has changed. If they start to do that, they have completely undermined the basic principle of the common law. And I think this court has done that not only in the McCutchley case, but in a number of others, and I think it's extremely dangerous.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, John. And Jay, anything you want to say in response to John's comment?
Just that the court, you know, is, I don't know, the court, I don't know how activist this particular Supreme Court is. I mean, you certainly can say, make an argument in either way. They actually upheld, you know, if we're talking about Obamacare, they actually upheld large parts of Obamacare. So I don't know that you can sort of say that it's one, it goes one way or another. I think it swings, and that is the point of the Supreme Court. You have, you know, four, nine justices, four of one and four of the other, and then a swing vote between. It's a very, you know, there are always going to be decisions that that people don't like on both sides, and that is sort of the nature of the beast of the judiciary.
Well, I do remember, Reed, this goes back when John Roberts was being confirmed, and he talked about calling balls and strikes, you know, in terms of looking at precedents. I don't want to get too bogged down in constitutional issues, but I'd just be curious about your response.
Well, yeah, I think the interesting thing about the Roberts court here is it's not as if he's I'm trying to work with a metaphor on the balls and strikes here. It's not like throwing to first base is suddenly a strike. What it is the strike zone has moved, you know, moves an inch or two now and then. This the McCutchen decision and several others on campaign finance reform, even Citizens United,
right,
were not big sweeping, let's kick the entire law off the books. You remember that the decision over the Voting Rights Act was just one section of the Voting Rights Act that was found unconstitutional. The change that the Roberts Court is bringing is coming incrementally. It is certainly moving towards those larger changes, but they're not taking the big home run swing right now. They're you know, hitting singles, if you will. We'll stick with the baseball references.
Okay, fair enough. Let me put something else on the table. I'll start with you again, Jay, which is the Senate Intelligence Committee voted last week to declassify a report about the CIA and its interrogation program. Apparently, I guess the next step is it's at the White House and the CIA to vet that information. How significant is this?
It's very significant, and this has really been the sort of baby of Senate Intelligence Committee chairman, Dianne Feinstein, who led this investigation. It was originally a bipartisan investigation. She and at that time Missouri Republican Kit Bond began the investigation together, although the Republicans quickly peeled away from that process and decided not to join in. And then she sort of continued the investigation on her own. It's a 6,300-page report. It is sweeping. It's enormous. If you listen to Dianne Feinstein's sort of descriptions of it, it is incredibly incriminating and really shows that the program should never have been started and that there was very little useful information that was gleaned from torture. And notably, when the Senate panel did vote this out last week, you had bipartisan support. You had Maine Republican Susan Collins actually voting to do this as well. So it has come sort of full circle. You know, a lot of Republicans in the middle of this did not really support the idea of too harshly criticizing the CIA for these tactics, and a lot of Republicans actually, frankly, still today believe that these tactics are important in order to get information, in order to defend our country. But there is there are still some Republicans out there, like Susan Collins, like Kip Bond, and others, who do believe that this is an important question to ask and an important issue to debate in the public, and that it should be debated in the public. This information should be made available to everybody to read, so that we can all have sort of a kind of national moment to reflect what are the values of America on this issue.
Well, in fact, let me quote from Senator Dianne Feinstein. She said, the purpose of this review was to uncover the facts behind the secret program, and the results, I think, were shocking. The report exposes brutality that stands in sharp contrast to our values as a nation. It chronicles a stain on our history that must never be allowed to happen again. This is not what Americans do. To you, Reid, and I noticed over the I guess it was yesterday, the CIA director, Michael Hayden, seemed to imply that Dianne Feinstein was being too emotional, and because of that, that raises questions about the objectivity of this report.
Somebody needs to get them some PR lessons.
Yeah,
I mean,
really.
The last word you want to use when you're talking about not only a sitting senator, but also somebody who chairs the committee that oversees your organization. This is the most interesting thing to me on this has been this sort of public, very public feud between the U.S. Senate, the United States Senate, and the Central Intelligence Agency. Feinstein, when she brought up some of the problems that she and her staff have been having with the CIA over this report. She did it on the Senate floor in a very loud and public way, which is huge, unprecedented, but it speaks to the frustrations that she has had. I mean, she accused the CIA of spying on Senate investigators. The CIA came out later that day and said, no, it was Senate investigators who had hacked into CIA computers, which I don't quite understand that. Given the Senate staffers that I know, they're not exactly computer geeks, but it became a very public, very angry feud, and it's going to have some serious repercussions, especially because Dianne Feinstein had been one of the intelligence committees, one of the intelligence community's biggest backers on Capitol Hill at a time when a lot of other people were criticizing them. She was an ally. Well, they've just alienated a pretty powerful and pretty serious ally.
Jay, where do you think this leaves the White House? As we know, President Obama hasn't really wanted to, go back over the Bush administration's programs, wants to look ahead, but nonetheless, here's this report.
And keep in mind that Obama, while he did end the program while in president, he does have, some of it did continue under his tenure, so he's not completely sort of in the clear here. It's certainly something the White House has been very hesitant to get involved in. They've really left this to Congress and to Dianne Feinstein to kind of litigate with the CIA. I agree with Reid, as Reid just says. He just said, I mean, they have to keep in mind that this woman controls their budget. she actually was one of their largest defendants, especially with things like Edward Snowden, and defending the laws that allowed the sort of NSA to snoop into Americans' emails and things like that. It is a huge loss for them, but it is striking how little the administration has said about this, and while they really just don't want to get involved, they don't really want to talk about it, and they aren't really taking sides between one or the other. We'll see what happens when the report is actually released and whether the president will address it.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation again. That's Jay Newton Small, Washington correspondent for Time Magazine. Also with us, Reid Wilson. He covers state politics and policy for The Washington Post. We are doing a national political roundup. We've talked about the U.S. Supreme Court decision. We've been talking about the Senate Intelligence Committee voting to declassify a report on the CIA's controversial interrogation program. We talked about Obamacare. We have other things to talk about as well. We want to hear from you. And again, that phone number 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Send us a tweet at Marty Moscowain. We'll be right back.
The National Constitution Center supports WHYY. The National Constitution Center is the museum of We the People, featuring the acclaimed multimedia show Freedom Rising, Signers Hall, and the story of We the People through artifacts, a rare copy of the Constitution, and interactive exhibits. April 9th through October 19th, Slavery at Jefferson's Monticello, a powerful exhibition that follows six enslaved families who lived and worked at Jefferson's plantation. More at 215-409-6700 or constitutioncenter.org.
We know that yawning is contagious, so is laughing, but so is stress. And those who are most susceptible are children. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll talk about contagious stress, what we know about it, what we can do to keep from taking it on and passing it on. That's today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
Support for WHYY comes from Delaware Valley College. Delaware Valley College offers a Master of Arts in Counseling Psychology that prepares culturally competent practitioners to work in the mental health field. Students can choose from social justice community counseling or child and adolescent counseling. More information about a Master's of Arts in Counseling Psychology from Delaware Valley College is available online at delval.edu/grad.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Reed Wilson and Jay Newton Small in Washington about the busy week in Washington last week. We'll also be talking about what's ahead and, again, getting some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We have a Facebook comment from Cyril. In light of the declassified CIA report on torture, why is there reluctance in the media to call torture torture? Jay, do you wrestle with this word?
It is certainly something that the CIA has taken exception to, and they say it's not torture, it's advanced interrogation techniques, as they put it. What do you describe as torture, and what do they describe as torture? And these are things that people have sort of tried to figure out for decades, if not centuries. I mean, is waterboarding torture? They would say it's not, but others would say absolutely it is. I think there are some people who would define it by any time somebody is put in a painful or uncomfortable or scary position. Others would say that it's not really torture unless you're drawing blood or making somebody believe that their life is in peril or actually imperiling their life, period. These are sort of definitions that will be debated long after this report is released. The question, I guess, is, you know, where do you draw the line? And that is the debate that Feinstein is frankly trying to have right now by releasing this report and by pursuing these definitions and investigating what has happened.
I mean, Reed, it seems like this is a good discussion or debate for the country to have.
It is, and we in the media are a bit constrained at times because we have these things called style guides, which tell us how we refer to how we use any number of identifiers for various things, everything from whether we call something enhanced interrogation techniques or torture to how we identify, you know, Senator Dianne Feinstein, D. California, or something like that,
right,
in our writing. So, it is a constant debate in newsrooms across the country, and a less sort of philosophical debate, I think, at least coming once this torture report comes out.
We have a tweet from Bill. What role do journalists play in informing the public about Obamacare? Why do Republicans control the terms of the debate? Can I toss that back to you, Reed?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are a number of ways in which Democrats have thought over the last several years that if people could just be made to see what Democrats were trying to do, then they would support this effort, whether it's the Affordable Care Act or cap and trade legislation or any number of things. And I think Republicans have controlled the debate very well. They planned from the beginning to demonize this particular piece of legislation. They have continued to do so. They've been aided increasingly by a set of Republican media, I should say conservative leaning media outlets, whether it's Rush Limbaugh's radio show or Fox News or something like that. Democrats were slower to get sort of their pitch together. Jay mentioned earlier that Democrats really haven't done a good job selling the bill, selling the intended consequences of the law and what good it would do for any individual. There are now the same sort of liberal media outlets, I don't say that in a pejorative way, MSNBC, the Mother Jones, groups like that, that make their living catering to that particular audience. There are conservative outlets that make their living catering to the other side of the debate, and in a lot of cases, it's up to the folks in the middle to bring out their own to cover essentially what each side is saying and to make some sense of it and to call truth truth. But Democrats really haven't done a good job in pitching their version of things.
Do you include the president on that as well?
Oh, absolutely. I think he has been one of the worst at selling his vision for the Affordable Care Act. I mean, We've heard the same things over and over. You know, if you like your doctor, you can keep it. That was named the lie of the year by one of the fact-checking organizations last year. It was not true. And there are significant indications that they knew it wasn't true when they were pitching this law. So, you know, one other thing Jay brought up earlier is that a lot of people who don't have insurance, if they get sick, if there's some catastrophe, they go to the ER. If they can't pay for their services, then we're stuck with the bill. I always wondered why Democrats didn't bring up that particular point. Well, hey, this saves you from having to pay for the guy down the street who didn't get insurance before he got in a car wreck. Now you're stuck paying his bill. We've never heard that from the White House.
Well, let me get Michael from Westchester to join us in Radio Times. Hi, Michael. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. You know, Dianne Feinstein has been one of the biggest supporters of these programs for years, and I just find it upsetting that it takes the shoe being on the other foot and her own computer being broken into before she finally takes people's concerns seriously that we've had for a long time.
Well, Mike, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And I know you're not alone in that thinking, which is that she seemed to be fine with the NSA, you know, being able to see not directly how people were communicating with each other. But the moment it affected her office, then she got upset. Jay, anything you want to add to that?
Well, I mean, there is a long history with the NSA when it was founded. It was used to, at one point, investigate secretly politicians, and that information was used against them. And there was, the age of J. Edgar Hoover, I mean, there's a long history and of tension within the government of government spying on government, and it is actually one of the most, I think, legal things that you can do, right, is to these days hack into a member's computer or spy in any way on a member or that the legislative branch, frankly, because there's such a very sensitive long history of that, and it really sort of, there's a lot of questions of impugning the division of power and the independence of each branch of the government if you have people spying on one branch spying on another branch. And so in that sense, she views it as very much a different thing when the CIA or breaks into her computers or spies on her versus the NSA sort of doing metadata targeting of all Americans, which, there's a lot of nuance here, I realize, but, the NSA theoretically doesn't actually look at that information. They're looking for certain catchwords. They can't use that information unless it's for specific reasons and they have, real sort of proof that this is something that is a danger to America. And so it's just a very different situation, the CIA versus the NSA, metadata versus a targeted computer of a member.
Thanks, Michael, for calling into Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number 1-888-477-9499. Reed, let me go back to you. Paul Ryan has introduced a budget. He's the House budget chairman. It looks like over a 10-year period, he thinks he can cut $5 trillion from the federal budget. Do those numbers add up?
They do if certain assumptions within the Ryan budget take place. And now this budget is largely similar, just like Bobby Jindal's healthcare plan. It's largely similar to the budget that we've seen in the past from him. He wants to save $5 trillion in part by rolling back the Affordable Care Act and by making changes to things like Pell Grants and the SNAP program, the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program. By the way, some liberal groups have pointed out that about 70% of the cuts in the Ryan budget would hit low-income families, whereas the Pentagon would get a $500 million increase over that 10-year period. So yeah. There's a bit of a statement there. The numbers add up if the economy booms. This is what some budget makers do. They assume that they'll be able to save as much or generate enough tax revenue if the economy suddenly starts doing really, really well. So this is why sort of at the end of this 10-year budget, he starts bringing in a lot more money and saving a lot more money because suddenly the economy starts doing great, of course, all because of him and the Ryan budget. Democrats do the same thing on this, sort of the funny budget numbers. So they add up if some of his assumptions come true.
Jay, something else I want to put on the table, which is President Obama seems to be doing some workarounds when it comes to Congress, going to states and talking about minimum wage this week. He's going to, I guess, use some of his executive powers to address some pay issues and federal contractors. Is this just the kind of frustration that he has working with Congress, or the fact that he can't get things through Congress and he's going to use the powers of the executive?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is, earlier, actually last month, he used his executive power to raise the federal minimum wage, or the minimum wage that federal workers make, to $10.10 an hour. Today, actually, he's using that same sort of pen, as he would say, to sort of executive orders that make it easier for women to get equal pay, sort of easier to disclose how much they make and compare it to others. So these are, the reason he's doing it is because, yes, these particular initiatives cannot get through Congress. It's an election year. And even besides that, these are not things that Republicans particularly want to see done. Mm-hmm. I was speaking to a Republican senator last week on the Hill who said if President Obama really was serious about raising the minimum wage, then he would, start with raising it to $9 an hour. It's $7.75 right now. Leaping it all the way to $10.10 is a huge leap, and it's just a non-starter for Republicans. They believe that it would be just way too expensive for businesses. It would cost a lot of jobs to do it, and they feel that it would just, it's just not something they're ever going to support. So it's sort of dead on arrival in the Senate this week. The Senate is going to attempt to vote on it, and it's probably not going to go anywhere without Republican support. And so, yeah, the president is using his pen to sort of circumvent Congress as much as he can. Now, how effective that is, I mean, he's only has the power to enforce this on the federal workforce, right, which is about a quarter of all jobs in America. So it's not a tiny amount, but it isn't, it doesn't really apply to the private sector.
Is it good politics, you think, Reid? I mean, is this what presidents do when they feel like their hands are tied?
Well, this is what presidents do in their second terms when Congress isn't behaving anymore. They sort of turn their attention to the executive. It's always interesting to see presidents evolve from working with Congress at the beginning of their first terms to realizing that Congress doesn't just do everything they want, to moving into the executive power phase in their second terms. But we're also in this time period, in that we're 215 days or so away from Election Day, that both sides are going to be forcing the other members of the other party into taking bad votes. Democrats see minimum wage polling very well. They will force Republicans to take a bunch of votes against the minimum wage to block it in the U.S. Senate, and then they'll go campaign on those votes. They'll get to say that Senator X voted against raising the minimum wage. Republicans in the House of Representatives will do the same thing. They'll hold, they've held, 55 or so votes to repeal or chip away at Obama. Obamacare. So every time a Democrat votes against that, they're going to be voting for mm-hmm. Obamacare. Congressman X voted for Obamacare 55 times. Of course, it's not entirely, sort of intellectually honest, but hey, this is the way politics works, especially at a time when Congress really isn't going to do much for the rest of the year. They have about three must-pass bills before they all get to go home and campaign. So now we're into the period of show votes.
So is it all about just running for election and re-election day?
It is. From now on in, basically, it is absolutely, almost every single thing that they do on the floor of the Senate, every word that they utter will be, all about television ads that they can then reproduce from C-SPAN footage and votes that they can then campaign on and say, look, Democrats will say Republicans don't care about the middle class. They didn't vote to raise the minimum wage. They don't care about women, that they don't care about women's pay equality. And Republicans will say that Democrats are, looking to cost American jobs and stifle the economy by these ridiculous huge increases of the minimum wage and they're stifling competition and that they're not investing in the right innovation and so it's just literally everything from here on in is a lot
That's
of
so depressing
yeah sound and fury and not a lot of substance.
We talked a bit about some of the Democrats' problems. I want to read about the Republican Party or even members of the Republican Party. I mean, it seems like there are some battles within that party as well.
There are. I think both parties are going through a generational shift right now from sort of an old guard to a younger guard. The Democrats have their sort of evolution has been masked a little bit because they have a unifying force in, you know, controlling the White House. On the Republican side, this fight has been going on since at least 2006, after George W. Bush's administration helped lose control of the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate. Republicans have been looking for sort of that path back to not only a majority in the House, but also the White House and the Senate. And right now, we're seeing a lot of those debates play out in states. There's a fascinating race going on right now in Mississippi, where Senator Thad Cochran is running for re-election. Cochran has made a career of bringing billions of dollars back to the state of Mississippi. He's the ranking Republican on the Senate Appropriations Committee. He has been an appropriations member for basically his entire career. And now he's running against a candidate, a state senator, who is saying, hey, we don't want to spend money. We don't want to bring home the bacon, if you will. This is a fight that's duplicated in Georgia, where another appropriator is running for Senate, in Kentucky, where Senator Mitch McConnell faces re-election. In all these cases, the Tea Party challengers, if you will, are trying to make the case that they don't want earmarks, they don't want more spending or anything like that, and it's really shaking up sort of the foundation of the Republican Party. So in the long run, I think this is a battle that's probably going to shake out for the establishment, at least this year. But, you know, the Tea Party is going to make a lot of noise, and this is a part of the evolution of the political parties that really, frankly, happens every 10 or 20 years.
Jay, 30 seconds. Anything you want to add to what Reed just said?
Certainly it is, you know, a huge generational shift, and it's something that, you know, Republicans and Democrats are going to be struggling with for a long time. I think the next legislative session will be very interesting towards that end, where you have them tackling immigration reform. Will Republicans agree to this reform, and what will it cost them in 2016 if they don't? And Democrats also have their own issues, you know, in terms of appealing to the left, keeping the base satisfied, you know, in 2016. So it certainly legislatively there's a lot going on next session, lame duck, and next session with trade and other issues that I think will be fascinating.
Jay Newton-Small, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Washington correspondent for Time Magazine, Reed Wilson, thank you very much as well.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. He covers state politics and policy for the Washington Post GovBeat blog. He's also editor and lead author of the Post's Read In Morning Tip Sheet. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program and to continue the conversation we started on the air today. Also, information about Twitter, Facebook, and how to download podcasts. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Green, Mom, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.